all the things that my mom and dad said to me throughout the years, there seems to be one phrase that sticks out amongst all the phrases that my mom and dad would say. It was when they would say, "It's time to come to the table." And this meant if I was outside playing with my friends, the playing had to stop. If I was watching television, the TV had to go off. And even if I was working on homework, the pencil had to be immediately put down. Now, I have to honestly say that whenever Mom and Dad said, "Andrew, it's time to come to the table," my sister and I didn't always, every time, drop what we were doing and come immediately, every single time, at their beck and call. But more often than not, for my sister and I, that time became a very special time for us. And it came for us what we'll call maybe an acquired discipline. See, one of the things that I know that my parents valued was rituals, traditions, and rhythms, maybe you could say. Every year there was a certain way we celebrated Christmas. Every year there was a certain way that we celebrated birthdays. And every night there was a certain routine that we had at bedtime. And for so many years when Mom and Dad were trying to start these rituals, these traditions, these rhythms, they got a lot of feedback. And a lot of it sometimes was negative from us. They got a lot of bit of resistance, and they got a little bit of pushback. But as the years grew on and we started to do these things more and more and more, those things that at one time we were giving a little bit of pushback to and we were getting a little bit of resistance from us, those actually got to be things that we actually grew to expect and things that we actually grew to love. And I even think about, you know, for us, every single Christmas, if my dad did not read 'Twas the Night Before Christmas in his Mr. T voice, to us it wasn't Christmas. And if before bed we didn't read Chicken Soup for the Soul and Mom didn't say Sleep Tight, Don't Let the Bed Bugs Bite, to us it wasn't bedtime. And so what I'm telling you as a family, as we focus on today, and you focus on building some traditions, some values, some rituals, some principles that will make up the very framework of your home, you will, in fact, likely get some resistance. You'll feel at times probably like you're literally paddling upstream to try to make these values and principles concrete in your home. But here's what's cool and what's going to happen. Is that the more you begin to set this type of foundation, the more you try to instill these type of values in your children and in your marriage, those things that at one time you found yourselves getting some resistance from, it will actually get to the point that your children will begin to expect and yearn to have those rituals, to have those traditions, and to have those rhythms to be a part of their life. There's a well-known sociologist by the name of Emily Durkheim, and Durkheim did a study, and she found this. She said that families that share a regular mealtime together, they showed several characteristics. Families that regularly ate together were more connected, more stable, more loyal, and as she puts it, they had a euphoric sense of well-being. And so perhaps there's no clearer picture of this than what we see in Acts 2, right? In what we'll call today the first Christian family. You think about how difficult this family really had it to establish a lot of these traditions, to establish a lot of these values. Because I know a lot of times in the church we can kind of look at that first Christian family and we can think, well, yeah, a lot of them saw some of the miracles of Jesus. You know, that would kind of inspire me to do great things. But think about the world they were living in. There was political upheaval. Politicians were always at each other's throats. There was wars. There was violence. It was very consumer-driven and materialistic type of world that they were living in. In fact, if you look in Acts chapter 2, it lists all these really hard-to-name groups of people, the Parthians, the Medes, the Edomites, and it lists all these people and all the evil that they're doing, and then it says, how in the world can we get out of this sick and crooked, and one translation actually says, stupid generation. Sound familiar? Yet despite all of that, they were able to build a solid Christian family. Let me tell you, that family was imperfect, but it was also a family that through the years was able to transform culture and to bless a lot of lives. And so this morning, that's going to be our framework as we get started. And what we're going to call this is the life of the dinner table. And we're going to have four different legs of our table, and we're going to use the first Christian family as our basis to understand really what it is that we as a family should look like. And these are going to be core principles that you're going to see not only us talk about this morning, but we're going to talk about throughout different lessons today. And the first thing is this, and kind of based off the video that we talked about, the first leg of your Christian home must be the ritual of consistent meals. One of the things that you notice in Acts chapter 2, especially as you look through verses 42 through 46, it says that they devoted themselves to the common meal. My wife and I, when we were first married, one of the things that we decided that we wanted to do, no question, is that whenever we ate dinner together, we were going to turn the TV off and we're just going to eat dinner and just talk. Now, when we were first married, we didn't even have a dinner table. We actually had to sit, I think, for about 3 or 4 weeks till someone came over and felt really sorry for us. We sat on the carpet in the living room on a coffee table for several weeks, and that was our dining room table. And I decided to get a little bit romantic and a little bit fancy afternoon. And so what I did is I got one of her pillar candles that we had left over from our wedding, and I put it in the middle of that coffee table, you know, just to spice things up a little bit. And so we're sitting there across the table, and for weeks we would just sit there, no TV. Part of it is we couldn't afford TV, but we would turn our cell phones off and just be absorbed in each other. But then life started to happen. And for those of you that have gotten to this point, you know what I'm talking about. You get a job, and then you get other jobs. And then you say yes to a lot of things that you shouldn't say yes to. And then later on, you add other things, and then you have a child or children. And so now, instead of there being a beautiful pillar candle and maybe a thing of gravy in the middle of our table in a nice, intricate bowl, you will look at our table now, and we have a stack of Berenstain Bears books, some crayons, some flashcards, and a little chalkboard just to keep his attention while we eat. Things change. And so for us, while it is such a welcomed and a wonderful change, one thing that we have found is exactly what I talked about from the very beginning, that you're going to have to work really hard to establish now those rituals, those traditions. Because it's so easy for us just to be like always in a hurry and to always be on the go and not really take that time to sit around the table and eat. And let's be honest, should this really be a surprise to any of us how big of a deal this is to sit around a table? Because one person, I think it was N.T. Wright, said as you look at the Gospels, one of the things that you'll see, especially in Luke, is that Jesus and his disciples literally ate their way through the Gospel of Luke. And that's a true point. You look on every single corner, you see Jesus and his disciples, it says fellowshipping, going to a banquet, breaking bread, sharing a meal. A lot of awesome things were happening around the table. Jesus was serving his apostles around the table. They were breaking bread with one another. Jesus was having sinners and tax collectors. There was conversions that were happening around the table. And we could even probably put it that the church was even founded right around the table. And so the table was such an intricate and a huge part. And let me tell you, it wasn't because of the meals. It wasn't because, you know, Miss Martha made a great casserole. The reason why they were brought around the table and why it was so important and so valuable was because of time spent together. One of the things that I've thought was kind of interesting is that I've heard, if you go over to Europe, that the European waiters and servers, they don't like their American customers. And the reason is when an American customer sits there at a table in Europe, they're always in a hurry. But the problem is, the European servers, they don't come and check on you rarely at all. They don't come and, you know, fill your drink every 2 minutes. In fact, you usually have just ice in your cup a good bit, even if you have ice, by the way, if you're in Europe. And so what happens is their whole goal and objective in Europe is, they don't want to come to your table a lot because they see it as something being rude, because to them, there's a perception that they're trying to get you in and out of there. That they want to rush you through that meal. Now, then you think about another thing that I heard, is they said in Europe, if you go to fast food restaurants or you go to most restaurants, they actually have a really thick padded cushion in their seats. And the whole point of the waiter not constantly being at your table and constantly kind of rushing you through, and the reason why you have a comfortable seat in Europe is they want you to stay. They want you to be around that table. They want you to be and to fellowship with one another. Then you get over to America, and you'll notice if you go to most restaurants, they have hard seats. And the whole reason why they have these things is because they want to get you in and out so that way they can hurry people up. And so do you ever get to a point, maybe if it's after a worship assembly and you go out to eat with some people, And when you go out and you're sitting around this table and you're enjoying in some fellowship, do you ever just feel absolutely robbed when your meal comes out way too fast? I know I do. Because here is a wonderful opportunity that we have to be with God's people. To have a little bit of that glimpse of what we talked about in Acts 2 where they broke bread and they were devoting themselves to that common meal. The catalyst for their growth. But yet so often we want to rush through this process. And so one of the things I hope that you can see as I look at Scripture, let me tell you how I take it. I don't look at the meal as something that is just supplemental or a good idea. I look at the meal and that trait of the church as being something that is absolutely God-ordained, and it's for a reason. The second thing is this, that needs to be the second leg of our family table, is biblical teaching. Of course, in 42 it says that they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching. Now, one of the things that you know is that they didn't devote themselves just to food, because Jesus, they understood, said, man doesn't just exist and is able to live off bread alone, but man must live off every single word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And so here's the question you have to ask yourself is, how real is this truth in your homes right now? How real and how consistent is biblical teaching in your home? I don't know about you, but I've kind of picked up on something that we can be very guilty of in the church, and it's this, that we can study our kids to death and really, you know, take that time, maybe watch the Joel Miller film strips with them, have studies every night because we want so bad for them to get into that baptistry and to be baptized. And so we get them into the baptistry, we study them so hard up into that point, but then once they get into the baptistry and they get out of the baptistry, then we kind of stop our teaching. That makes no sense. It's kind of like you get your 12-year-old to the point where he's 12 years old, and then you're like, okay, good, he made it to 12. He made it past, you know, the hardest growth spurt, so now what I'm going to stop doing is I'm going to stop giving him, you know, water and protein and vegetables and fruit, all those things that he needs to live. But yet we just try to get him in the baptistry, hurry up, get him in there, and we're like, yes, we did it. Let me tell you, that's the beginning of the faith journey. And then even more they're going to need that teaching. Let me tell you, I don't know if you've been to a middle school. They need biblical teaching. They need these types of things in their life to be consistent and to be rituals and to be traditions in the home. Now, there's a story about a family that had five young men that were in the Navy. And four of the five young men actually did not remain faithful to the church, except for one young man. And he was actually asked by one of his ministers at his congregation, you know, what was it that was different about you than all the four other guys? Why were you able to remain faithful to your family, but also more importantly, faithful to God? And he said, well, there was one time where I was getting ready to fly overseas. And right before I was getting ready to leave, my four brothers had already been there and done that, and they had not remained faithful. And he said, I just remember Mom and Dad and me, and we were standing there about to take flight. And he said, my dad opened up the Bible, and he began to read about God's protection and God's guidance. And he said, and then in that little circle, Dad prayed that I would remain faithful, and that they as a family would be the support to me that I needed. He said, so while we were out there, someone actually took a picture of us holding hands and praying together with the Bible opened in the center. And so when I was overseas, I got it mailed to me in a letter. He said, I took that picture of me and Mom and Dad with the Bible open, with our hands joined in prayer, and I put it in the inside of my jacket. He said, so anytime that I got to a point where I was tempted to do something that I shouldn't, he said, all I could do is have a flashback of what I had kept close to my heart. And so my question for you is, what is it as your children leave, take that flight, take that next step into their life that they are going to be carrying around with them? Is it going to be those biblical principles? I think about Deuteronomy 6. It's kind of hilarious in the way if you think about it. Talking about even writing God's commands on your forehead. Let me tell you, if you're that quick to forget them, maybe that's a good idea. But the importance of making these things the forefront of everything that you do. So the third leg is this one. We as a family must establish the difference between needs and wants. It's no secret, living in the middle of the most want-generating machine of all time. We're living in what a lot of people call the age of entitlement. So how do we combat this? I think it starts with this. What we have done is we have to honestly look at ourselves and realize we have raised a generation of spiritual consumers instead of spiritual contributors. And so what we have to do is we have to take a step back and we have to realize, we have to teach our children that the world does not exist for us, but we as the church exist for the world. So that we are the ones to serve, that we are the ones to give. In fact, I think about this being really something that was on my mind lately when Eric Gray and Andrew Jenkins asked me to do a podcast on how to keep your children faithful past high school and what to do when you get into those college years. And I really hadn't actually taken a whole lot of time to really think about what were the common characteristics of the kids that came into my campus ministry, that came as freshmen and left as seniors faithful to God. But there was one characteristic that I noticed. Those kids that were taught to serve remained faithful. The kids that would be like, "Hey, Andrew, is there like a youth class that I could teach? Hey, what kind of service things are we doing?" And every time there was a service thing all around the corner, they were at every single thing. See, what their parents taught them is that they are not just consumers, but they are to be contributors. You think about one of the things that is mentioned in a book that maybe a lot of you may have heard of, You Lost Me. It talks about why kids have fallen away from the church. And one of the things that he says is that we haven't expected much out of our children. And we really haven't. I think back into what happened back in the old law, in the old day, and what you see happening as the church is transitioning to being Christ's church in the New Testament, that kids by the age of 12, they had the first five books of the Old Testament completely memorized. But yet we say, well, yeah, we can't push them too much. We can't get them to, you know, be overly involved in teaching. These kids were 12 years old and had the first five books of the Bible memorized. And so there is an ability to learn, but there's also an ability to discern at that age, to discern what the difference is between needs and wants. So how practically speaking can we do this? Well, expect stuff out of them. Elders, deacons, get your kids involved in leading in the church, leading prayers, leading singing, serving in the Lord's Supper table, getting them to be involved in teaching Bible classes for little kids. Another thing I think about to do is maybe just drive through a neighborhood of people quite often that don't have it nearly as good as you do. And remind your kids of all the blessings that they have in their life. There's a man that challenged my parents to, by the age of 13, to make sure that we go on some type of overseas mission trip to a third world country by the age of 13. And so my dad took them up on that offer. And so by the age of 13, my sister and I both had went to a third world country on a mission trip. And one of the things that my mom always said is she said, "Y'all were changed people when y'all got back from that trip." Now, I'll probably say it only lasted for 2 weeks, but I'm sure that 2 weeks was awesome for my mom and dad. And so this was something that they ended up doing to help us get a little bit of perspective about how blessed we are. There's another family I think of in Tennessee that one of the things that they do to help establish the difference between needs and wants and for them to see how truly blessed they are is that whenever they have a Christmas or Thanksgiving meal, one of the things that they do as a family is they invite a family that does not have much money or a family that does not have a relationship with God into their home for that Christmas meal or that Thanksgiving meal. And it's similar to what we talked about early. What ended up happening was is the kids were giving them some resistance about that. It was like, well, this is our holiday. You know, this is Christmas is for us and Thanksgiving's for us. We're supposed to have this time together. And the mom and the dad said, listen, we got a whole lot of resistance on this, and we felt like we were, in fact, paddling upstream with this idea. She said, but guess what? Now that they have their own kids, guess what they do every Thanksgiving and every Christmas? They have people into their homes. Think in Acts 2:44, it says this thing that just absolutely blows my mind. It's still kind of hard to fathom. It says that they had everything in common. I guess that's difficult for me to think about because I think about, man, I have so much not in common with so many people, and I think a lot of it is my own fault. Because think about what it was that made them have things in common. It says they took an assessment of all the things that they had, their own possessions. They saw needs. And so they made sacrifices. They established the differences between needs and wants. They sold their possessions, gave the money to the poor, and then they had things in common. I think there is a very important link there between service and a humble attitude and how to get along with other people. The fourth leg of the table is this one, prayer and praise. Again, in verses 42 through 46, 42 says that they devoted themselves to prayer, and 46 it talks about how they were constantly worshiping and praising God together. This is a very simple one that can be done tonight. How many times do you maybe just go around the table and talk about what's right with your children's day? Or a way to praise God, or to even ask for a prayer request of something that's going on. Even if it's just Johnny's fish that needs help, or you know his best friend at school, you know her puppy died. You know, whatever it is, this opportunity to praise God, to lift things up before God and to come together. Because think about it. Most of what our children hear on a daily basis is probably negative. And a lot of the messages that they're hearing are likely negative. So make the table in this time to come together with each other a safe place where they know they can get a little bit of positive so that they actually look forward to that time together. One of the things that I think about with this one is when Lorianne and I were first dating, I was going to her grandparents' house for Thanksgiving, and I was a little bit nervous because this was the first time to meet the family. And so we're sitting around the table. We just get there, like, I think 5 or 10 minutes before, and we're sitting around the table, and her granddad says, "All right, I want to do what we do every meal, is we want to go around the room and for everyone to tell what they're thankful for." And I was like, okay, great. It's not Last Leaders. I didn't prepare a 4.5 to 6 minute lesson here of what to say. So I was really getting nervous. I was like, I know I got to impress. And so he goes, we'll start with Andrew. I was like, yeah, that was purposeful. So he started with me. And let me tell you, I was absolutely nervous. I did not enjoy that first one, okay? I don't think anything that I said makes sense. I maybe thanked him for the grass and you know the carpet. I don't really know. And so it went around the room, and so every single year we started doing this, and now this has gotten to be something that I absolutely love, and I crave it. Again, this is what we're getting back. A lot of the traditions, the rituals that you are going to try to establish in your home, these values we're talking about this weekend, are things that you are going to get some resistance, but they will grow to be things that your family grows to expect. As we close, I want you to think about what all four of these legs of the Christian table really are providing. To me, they're providing these two powerful things, security and purpose. Security and purpose. You know, for your kids to know, for your husband, your wife to know that, hey, this is a safe place. And this is a place where I know I'm going to get this, that I know I'm going to get some positive, I know I'm going to get some encouragement. In a world that is not positive, in a world that is completely unbalanced and at times chaotic, let your home be a place of security. But then also, these are all about providing a purpose for your family. A lot of you may have heard about this, but the London Transit Authority, I think it was about 10 or 12 years ago, was having a problem. And what they were doing was their buses were passing all the bus stops. And like one in every 5 stops, people were actually getting picked up. And so obviously people were complaining. They were late for work. And so they got all these bad reviews online. People were riding the London Transit Authority. And so they ended up, the London Transit Authority, it spoke back and they spoke to the media. And this is what they had to say. They said the reason why we haven't made all of our stops like we need to make them is because if we make all of our stops, we'll be late at other stops. Now, they are called the London Transit Authority. So, right, we would think that their purpose is to what? Transport. Not necessarily just to be on time every time. And when I think about that example, I think about us, that sometimes we can be just like them. We can forget what it is that our true purpose is. It's not about all about what we can gain, but it's all about what we can contribute. And all that we can pass down, and the legacies that you and I can leave behind. And one of the things I think about as we close is what Joshua said in Joshua 24:15. He said, listen, I know pretty much what everybody else is doing. I know what different homes look like and how different things are going. And he's probably saying something that maybe you've said to yourself. I wonder if he said, yeah, because I'm hearing my kids, they come home and they say, well, so-and-so's family's doing this. You know, he's 7 and he has an iPhone. You know, And so they're hearing these things, and then Joshua says, listen, as for me and my house, meaning I know what everybody else is doing, but as for me and my house, what we're going to do is this. We're going to serve the Lord. And at times that's not going to be popular. At times that's going to be odd. At times that's going to be different. But guess what? Light is bright. And salt has a little bit of tang and a sharp taste to it, does it not? But you remember it. So let's make sure that our homes are not something of a facade where we just talk about biblical things on Sunday and Wednesday and not practice them Monday through Friday. Let's make our home, as Joshua describes it, a fortress where God is the very center.